If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on this Monday afternoon. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Frank Senna from Crane Chicago Business joins us as well, as he does most Mondays. Frank, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
All right, so the 21st century has finally undone the damage done by Prohibition to the brewing industry here in the city of Chicago.
That's right. Chicago, by some measures, is now the craft beer capital of the United States.
How did that happen?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of good fresh water that's available and from Lake Michigan, a lot of cheap storage space, a lot of appetite for craft beer. You know, craft brewers right now occupy about 1.6 million square feet of commercial real estate. That is more than any metro area in the country. Only Portland outstrips us in the number of craft breweries, with 144 here to Portland's 196. So we're even gaining on them in that score.
And, you know, I just don't think it's the sort of thing that a lot of Chicagoans would say that we're leading at.
No, it was a surprise to me. And this is a first report from Seattle-based brokerage Colliers International. So in the coming years, we'll see, you know, how those rankings, you know, turn into head-to-head matchups and how much we gain, how much we lose. But right out of the box, we're doing pretty well.
It is pretty remarkable, too, reading the story in Crane's. I was joking about Prohibition, but there were 12.4 million gallons of beer produced in 2014. The last peak was around the start of the 20th century. The city had about 60 small breweries combined to produce about 100 million gallons of beer a year.
Yeah, so in terms of volume, we still have a long way to go to hit that pre-prohibition level. But in terms of just the sheer number of craft brewers, it's outstripped that.
Yeah, well, I mean, two things. One, that you know, we're well on, maybe not well on our way, but you know that it's become a real industry here. But who'd have thought? I didn't know that we were brewing 100 million. Gallons of beer a year in the early 20th century.
Well, if you go into Wicker Park, you see that Brewers Row, those old mansions that have been, many have been converted into, you know, like four or five flats. But yeah, there's a whole area near Big Star, near the
Taco Joint,
Damon North in Milwaukee. Yeah, that are you know, turn of the century mansions from some of these guys back in the day.
I'll have to check that out. But you know, so that's significant too, though, because we talk about how these craft breweries are kind of moving into empty industrial sites, but more and more now these craft, they're not just making beer to sell at the grocery store, right? They're making beer to sell at the location, so they've got to kind of be in the right location.
Exactly. I mean, if you look back at the history of the latest boom, that would have been dating to 1988 when Goose Island opened its facility, and I actually wrote a story about that at the time, so I remember trying the cheese beer soup and this, you know, and seeing the still and everything. Now it's kind of gone back to that. They want foot traffic. You know, Three Floyds down in Indiana is in an industrial park, and it's still very popular. But more and more, with all the competition, these craft brewers are looking for storefronts that they can open and get some people in and serve them that fresh product.
Let's give a nod to John Hall too, because I was around back there in the mid to late 80s when he opened up Goose Island. And
maybe we were sitting down the bar from each other.
I think I owe you a beer, maybe. I think that. but how nice is it that, you know, this guy's become a pioneer? I know his son was in the business. His son, right, sold some.
Yes.
And because that's another trend, these microbreweries or these craft brewers who are then selling to the big companies who are desperate for their share of the market.
Absolutely. The big guys are buying up the craft brewers. And then, yeah, his son went on to found the cider operation. And, you know, then just recently sold that.
All right. So there you go, craft breweries in Chicago. And let's go to another, well, I don't know, it's an emerging market, maybe not, but the near west side. You know, it's sort of known as Restaurant Row or a Restaurant Row in West Randolph. And Crane's is writing now that it's becoming maybe a fine apparel area as well.
Yeah, so if you go over there to try out Next and Publican and all those great spots, I just had a great dinner at Nelcote recently. you are starting to see...
Listen to that. I'm talking to Cup here. Go
I'm
ahead.
I'm telling you, man. I love the... Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think they're going to send me a free meal, though. And that's not what I'm angling for. But if you go to the neighborhood to see some of those fine dining establishments, you're going to see more and more boutiques. Tooth and jowl with these guys. Maria Pinto, the Chicago designer who's outfitted the First Lady, Michelle Obama. She just set up a studio this month on Washington Street out in the West Loop for her M2057 line of separates that are aimed for the career-minded woman. Billy Reed, a luxury label, opened its two-story space on Randolph near Graham Elliott Bistro in September. And Kit and Ace, a new blended cashmere outfitter launched by Lululemon founder Chip Wilson, opened on Fulton Market also in September. So you've got three bellwether boutiques out there saying, look, we're gonna be competing with the restaurants and the tech startups for
so
all that space.
So if it came down to it, Frank, and you had to choose between Maria Pinto and Kit and Ace, which boutique would you go into?
I would choose to go to that new fried chicken joint at Fulton Market.
But it's they're similar stories, the craft breweries and these, in a way, because they still now are relying on foot traffic. And the question in the Fulton Market area is whether or not there's enough foot traffic to fund these boutiques.
During the daytime hours, for sure. I mean, what you've got, though, now is a lot of these tech startups and larger tech companies like Google have office space over there. So you've got a lot of office workers where you didn't have them before. And the average West Loop household now has an annual income of more than $120,000 and spends about $3,000 on retail purchases each month. So, you know, there may in fact be a sustainable level of foot traffic. And then if you get enough of those places, it becomes kind of a destination too.
Well, and that's what I like. I like just the idea of cities being alive and, you know, the ebb and flow. You know, they're moving in right now. It's the Fulton Market area. There was a statistic too. The 60607 zip code, which is part of the West Loop area, is up more than 50% in the past 15 years. So they're moving over there.
Let's get a place.
We'll have
a beer at Goose Island. We'll get a place at Fulton Market.
And then we can go get outfitted at Maria Pinto a little bit later.
It's a date.
That's Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. So how has your industry done since 2015? Career Builder has a new survey out there looking at it. The areas where wages have gone up quite a bit in the Chicago area and others where maybe not so much. We'll talk with Frank about that. It's 12:21. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand in on this Monday afternoon. Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business is here as well. All right, so Career Builder has been looking at different industries, where they make more money, where they make less, since the year 2000, correct? 2000?
Yes.
And are these Chicago numbers? Or?
So they are looking at highly compensated workers in Metro Chicago. They've been saying that it has increased, their pay has increased 2.2% since 2010. That compares with a drop of 1.2% for all wage and salary employees in the area. So the rich have gotten richer, and the rest of the city has gotten a little poorer.
Well, it's still pretty amazing. So from 2010 to now, so over the past 5 years, even these high wage earners are seeing their income only up by a couple percentage points?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some great variations in the subsections, though. So you've got in the pharmaceutical and medicine manufacturing industry, they are up a whopping 25.5% in compensation to average of almost $164,000 in the last 5 years. So that they outpace everybody else. And also doing well, scientific research and development services, up almost 16% to $128,000.
Now, Frank, I'm just thinking out loud, but is that the sort of thing that parents should be talking about when they talk to their kids about STEM education?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you ultimately can get into a very high-earning area if you have the scientific chops, for sure.
And as far as legal services, not so much. That's one of the areas where they've actually dropped.
Yeah, legal services are down 5.4% in the last 5 years, still doing a good six figures, $107,000. But the biggest drop was in management, scientific, and technical consulting services, down a little over 8% to, again, around $105,000.
Why do you suppose that is? Any idea?
You know, I think with consulting, that is a real feast and famine type business. I think, you know, if people are taking more in-house, doing more hiring, you know, conversely, during a downturn, you might use more consultants because you're trying not to add to your workforce. And so when times are good, you might, you know, be hiring more people on staff. And so, you know, maybe the consultancies lag a little bit.
So as things improve, consultancy looks less attractive.
Yeah, maybe more competitive environment out there.
The other thing is, if you look at computer system design and related services, down, not a lot, but down 2% since the year 2000. And that just to me is an indication of how, you know, we and again, being a parent of college students, you try to pick what's going to be your career, what's going to pay off. Things change.
Yeah, because 10 years ago, you would have definitely chosen that as the big hot growth.
Right. Kid, go into computers. It's going to change your world.
But interestingly, if you look at areas where, you know, you can have less than a highly specialized education, banks, credit unions up 10% to about 82,000, and airlines up almost 16% in the last 5 years to 86,000. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to have an advanced degree to be a high paycheck earner.
That's a really good point. Now, I don't understand that airline one. Are those pilots and flight attendants, you think?
I think it's the whole schmear. You know, everybody in the Chicago area who works in airlines, you know, mechanics, pilots, flight attendants, front office, you know.
Baggage carriers, would they be included?
Probably, yeah.
All right, we'll put them all in there.
So, yeah, lump them all in.
Let's go to the CME, because there might be some employees there who are looking for work soon, right? They're sort of shrinking their operations in Chicago?
Yeah, so the CME Group, which runs those, you know, exchanges we always hear about on the business lunch, they have been cutting their Chicago workforce. They're down to 1,800 this year from 2,100 in 2012. So they've lost, you know, about 300 over the past 3 years. But at the same time, what they're doing is they're repositioning themselves to make a bigger footprint overseas. So staff outside the U.S. has grown to 17% of overall employees, up from 7% 5 years ago. So they're really making it more global play rather than, you know, just doing a big cutback.
And one more thing, there is a bank acquisition in the news that I think Cranes broke pretty much over the weekend, MB Financial buying American Chartered.
Yes, a big deal. You saw it first on ChicagoBusiness.com. It is really remarkable in the sense that the valuation of $449 billion was 2.35 times American Chartered's book value. And that valuation shows what the financial stocks are doing right now. It's closer to what banks were fetching before the financial crisis and far above what Chicago area lenders have been selling for since. So this may signal, you know, that there's fewer big deals to be had. You know, the economy's doing well, so it fetched a very premium price there. MB is definitely shoring up its commercial portfolio.
So a big bank going after a smaller bank to improve its market share.
Absolutely.
Hey, that's how we started, with the big breweries buying up the smaller ones.
That's right.
Frank Senna from Crane Chicago Business. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is a Monday afternoon, 12:36, and Todd Connor joins us as well, the CEO, founder, really, of The Bunker over at 1871. Todd, talk right into that microphone.
Right,
thanks,
Steve,
for coming over. Appreciate it. I know you're busy.
Thanks. I know. It's great to be with you.
All right. Let's get in the elevator and go up to like 12th, 13th floor and give me an explanation of what The Bunker is.
Sure. So The Bunker is a business organization that we started that helps military veterans start and grow businesses. So we are focusing on entrepreneurs, military veterans that served in the military, got out, and want to start a business.
So a sort of a micro unit of 1871?
We are a micro organization inside of 1871. I like to say 1871 is an incubator of incubators.
Okay.
So there's about 8 to 10 different standalone programs inside of 1871. We're one of those. So we're housed at 1871. We're the first thing you see when you come in the doors, but we're an independent organization.
I want to ask you about something you said about veterans and veteran entrepreneurs. When civilians talk about vets, they assume it's an identity class. But when veterans talk about veterans, it's a group of people that have shared an experience that's really distinctive and special. Mm-hmm. Flesh that out for me a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of challenges that the veteran community is facing around, you know, mental health and unemployment and these things. And I think there's a challenge in that when people want to try to help veterans, you know, there's a risk that they just get the messaging wrong. And there's a lot of veterans, the vast majority of veterans who've gone out, served the military, they feel great about their experience, they're very proud of it. I think for them, a lot of them, they get back, they move to Chicago, they, you know, live downtown, what have you. And what they see from a marketing standpoint for the veteran community feels very disconnected to them. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't actually remind them of what they did in military service. And so I like to remind people that, you know, we're talking about a group of people that when they were 18 years old, they joined the military because they heard things like the few, the proud, the Marines. They heard things like Army, you know, Army strong or Army of one. I mean, we sold to them on this very aspirational language when they had a choice at the age of 18. And yet on the backside, you know, that aspirational language is really absent. And so we're trying to bring that forward with the bunker.
One of the things I've learned sitting here and talking to different groups when it comes to veteran hiring and different vets is I, you know, foolishly always thought of veterans jobs programs as doing veterans a favor. Mm-hmm. And not the other way around, that really what you're doing is tapping into a pretty remarkable population, a problem-solving population, an entrepreneurial group of people. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of the thing. The message is upside down.
I think the message is upside down. We've got some work to do to kind of correct the brand recognition of veterans, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, people could think that veterans are very sort of hierarchical, strict, rigid, give them an order, they'll get it done. But they're actually a very entrepreneurial class of people. I mean, they've had to do things in really adverse circumstances. I mean, go with six buddies and go, you know, scan these three blocks in a foreign country right. Where you don't speak the language. I mean,
that's not just entrepreneurial. That's teamwork too.
It's teamwork. It's entrepreneurial. It's values driven. It's mission focused.
All right, let's go back to the bunker.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, please.
So the first class sort of introduced a year ago, I think there were 19 different, entrepreneurs, right?
Yeah.
Who started a year out. How are they doing?
They're doing great. You know, the numbers would reflect the challenges of entrepreneurship. A couple of them have gone back to corporate roles. The vast majority of them are continuing on with their businesses. Two or three of our companies had some really phenomenal, big, multi-million-dollar years, which was exciting
nice.
And surprising. Others of them have raised their seed round, and they're going on to raise a Series A round. They've built products. They've hired employees. I think our count is at about 136 part-time or full-time jobs have been created through the work of these 19 companies. So it's just been a phenomenal experience to watch this group of individuals and these companies grow.
And after a year then, do they move on?
So they, you know, we sort of like, we have a graduation moment, but a lot of them stay with us. I mean, I think, you know, people join the bunker, but nobody quite ever leaves it because, you know, you just sort of evolve in your contribution. The reality is this is a group of people that wants to be in community. So the idea of, hey, you're done now, go away, doesn't make sense to them. So, I mean, a lot of them now have evolved to becoming mentors to the next class. A lot of them have evolved to having larger impact where they can. Even some of the ones that have, you know, their entrepreneurial endeavor hasn't worked out, they're now doing things. We have one guy who runs Illinois Joining Forces for the state. And so he's kind of in a leadership role helping us. So we continue to talk to, I think, everyone that we've touched, and they just find their own new ways of contributing.
Well, I think that speaks to success then, right? I mean, if you've got people who are sticking around in one way or another, in one fashion or another, that shows that what you're doing is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
The next class is in.
Next class is in.
Are they feeling a little pressure?
They
sophomore
are.
Class?
Oh, yeah. And we've upped our game. And so it's tough. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always get better. I mean, I think it's part of just thinking of, you know, we went out last year and it was our first attempt and we really built a strong program, but we saw opportunities to make it even better. So we actually launched a program on Veterans Day, which was last week, called Epic, which is basically an evening program, Wednesday nights, for people that are currently working full-time or still in the military who want to start a business. And so we think, you know, the way most people start businesses is that they have a day job and then they tinker at night. And so we wanted to build a program that honors that sort of life transition. So we've got a blockbuster group of 18 folks that are coming every Wednesday night, and they've got businesses. I mean, a lot of them have a business, they're making money, but they still have that day job. So they're trying to figure out when do I have enough money that I can actually quit my day job and go do this thing full time.
Talking to Todd Connor here, the CEO of The Bunker at 1871. So, you know, sometimes we have these conversations and we don't really, I'm not sure the right way to put it, but we can talk about entrepreneurs. We can talk about, you know, getting go-getters, having meetings on Wednesdays. But give me a specific scenario of a business and what they're doing and what they're picking up on a Wednesday night that helps them through the rest of the week.
Oh, sure. We've got a guy, John Gorospe, who served in, I think he was in the, John was in the Army, young guy, got out using the GI Bill to go to DePaul, and he's about to graduate there. And he built an app, a technology app called Suggest That. And it's basically like Yelp, but with video reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that you get a more authentic experience. If you're forced to film a recording of yourself evaluating, you know, TGI Fridays, you're going to get something more authentic and real. Like when I describe whether or not I like the cheese fries, something that's better than just a written review on Yelp. And there's a lot of spam that goes into kind of online reviews.
Sure.
And things like that. So he built this platform. It's great technology. It takes a picture while shooting a video. It's kind of slick in terms of its API and how it presents, and it's got some great technology. And he came to us, and he's trying to sort of go to market in a mass way, which is very, very, very tough. So we've been working with him, and what he's learned is he's got to take his business model, which he's trying to go direct to consumer. So, I mean, standing out here in front of the WGN building, trying to get people to download the app, very tough way to go to market. So what we did was we kind of flipped his business towards a B2B business where he can go and sell his technology to existing companies. So he's talking to like Buffalo Wild Rings about creating a contract sell his technology into them. So for these guys, it's like smart guys, good technology, good ideas, but they need some help on the business strategy. And so a lot of what we do early stage is help play with their business models to figure out how are you actually going to get traction? How can you make some money to get this thing going?
You mentioned that some of these people coming in on Wednesdays are still in the military.
Mm-hmm.
You're starting a new program, Bunker in a Box.
Bunker in a Box.
And is that for active duty people now?
That is.
Explain that for
yeah.
me.
So we looked at everything we were doing in Chicago and in other chapters around the country and said, how do we basically package this and give it to people at scale? Because not everyone can come to 1871 and hang out with, you know, with us on Thursdays. So we created an online gamification platform, which is basically a way to learn entrepreneurship.
So, gamification.
Gamification. So think about it's like playing Call of Duty, but instead of killing bad guys, you're earning points, earning medals, earning ribbons for learning about entrepreneurship.
Wow, interesting.
It's pretty slick. It's really slick. And gamification is very hot in the ed tech sector. It's why we like Fitbit. It's why we like Candy Crush, frankly, and other things that give us rewards. So this whole idea of gamification is really good. And so we took it and said, how do you use gamification as a learning approach to active duty military? Because the reality is, starting a business takes years. You're thinking about it, right? So you might be in Iraq and you've got 18 months left in your deployment, and sometimes it's very intense, and then a lot of times there's downtime and it's very boring. And so we were like, how do you take that asset of time that these service members have while they're getting ready to get off in military and give them something of value to learn? So we organized over 1,000 hours of content, TED Talks, best-in-class thinking from guys like Steve Blank and, you know, Lean Startup and Business Model Canvas and all this stuff. And then we shot a bunch of videos ourselves, including wow. interviews with veteran entrepreneurs, and rolled all that into 14 missions into this whole online platform so anybody around the world can go log on and start competing.
I have an 18-year-old playing Call of Duty in the basement. I'd like to slip that into his PlayStation.
Not quite as cool as Call of Duty, not yet, but we're working on that. But yeah, exactly.
Todd Connor, the CEO of The Bunker at 1871. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
That's Euro Money on 720 WGN.
Thank you, Steve Alexander, Kim Gordon, and Dolly McCarthy, and also Amy Guth. Wait a minute, Amy Guth is here now.
Hello.
To talk about social media. Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How's it going today?
It's great, but you know, so I want to be responsible, and obviously people are on edge in Brussels, and I don't know what to make of the story in the New York Times. Is it today, I think?
Mm-hmm.
So the police there had said, look, let's tone down social media a little bit. Don't be posting where you are and all of that. Get out of the way and let us look.
Right. Specifically, the Belgian police asked that no one do anything on social media that would interfere with police work. But generally, the ask was, hey, lay low on social media. Don't do anything that's not necessary. You know, don't do anything that's don't try to be posting your whereabouts, doing all this stuff. Don't mess with anybody.
We don't care that you had the waffles.
Yeah. Lay low today. We're trying to do some good work, but we're also looking at social media channels. And so Belgium responded in a way that I also don't know what to make of it. They responded with cats. They're picture. I mean, this was in the New York Times. This is a fascinating story. Some of the pictures are quite funny, but again, this is such a serious issue, and it's got to be a very stressful time to be in Brussels if you're on lockdown. It's the highest terror alert possible that has been issued for Brussels, and yet people are posting pictures with cats posing with little toy guns and saying, like, we got him, and things like that. So on one hand, you have to kind of give them props for trying to find...
Were these Belgians doing this?
Primarily, yes, okay. But some other people got in on it, too. So, I mean, on one hand, you have to say, you know, if you're stuck in your house during a fearful time, I suppose I could understand why you would want to find some levity in it, but... And again, it's a very serious topic. But even eventually, the Belgian police got in on it, and they
weren't posting kitten pictures.
They posted cat food and said, we appreciate everyone's cooperation.
Is that right, really?
Please treat yourselves. So it seems like such a strange reaction. I mean, certainly one that culturally I don't think we can identify with. I think if that was issued here in Chicago, I don't think we would be having the same reaction. But here we are. And so the New York Times has kind of a roundup of all these photographs. I have to admit, some of them are actually pretty funny.
This,
I mean,
might be
weird.
The most upside down thing.
So, it's very weird.
I didn't read far enough in to know that the police had tweeted out a picture of cat food.
Yes.
Okay, so really, I don't know what to make of it. And so, and you?
I mean, I'm very torn. I mean, I think it's, I would think a police directive to stay off of social media is a police directive to
stay off of social media,
not clog it with cats. But, you know, I think it's hard for us to speak to the cultural, you know, hive mind of another country. We can only kind of speak for what we would do here.
And, you know, there's also probably, not to go all psychoanalytical on everyone, but, you know, it's like being trapped in a snowstorm for a few days.
Right.
You start to get a little giddy and
yeah,
do some silly things.
Sure. And cats are certainly silly. I mean, certainly, some of them seem to be
crossing
the line.
Sorry, did you say cats are certainly silly?
Cats are certainly silly.
Okay, I thought you did.
I mean, cats are certainly... To post cats in response to terror, I think, is silly. But I think there seems to be a sense of, like, we're not going to let any of this diminish our spirits or like, ruin our joy. We're going to have fun with this. So it's a strange call, but here we are.
It is very strange. Also strange is the... You know, so will Zuckerberg be remembered as, like, a Vanderbilt or a Rockefeller or... You know, here's one of the guys, one of the most influential people commercially and socially in our world right now. He's about to have a baby.
Mm-hmm. He's about to have his first child with his wife, Priscilla Chan.
And he announced he's going to take 2 months off to help bring the baby into the world.
Yes. And it's a really interesting time in Silicon Valley around the topic of parental leave, because we see Marissa Mayer at Yahoo, who barely took any time off with her first child.
And then she had twins.
Right. She's announced she is having twins, and she said, I plan to take only 2 weeks off for that. So then we see Spotify and Pandora and all these tech giants announcing new parental leave policies. We see some of them saying, you have unlimited parental leave. You can do whatever you want the first year of your child's adoption or life or whatever.
But they say that, but then they also, people who work there say, yeah, but there's pressure for us not to do it.
Right. There is that. So anytime there's a company that announces a really generous parental leave, you have to look at culturally what is there. And I think a lot of that comes from the top. A lot of people say, well, it's really important for the boss to do that, because if your boss is not doing that, you really don't feel like you can do, you know,
sure,
take advantage
sure.
of that full leave. So it'll be interesting to see what happens at Facebook culturally now that Zuckerberg is saying, hey, I'm taking these 2 months off. And he's in fact, you know, citing things like, hey, there's a lot of research that suggests that it's much more beneficial to the family unit and to the child if parents are present at the very, you know, beginning of his or her life.
It's not quite as upside down as cats and terrorism, but I'm all for parental leave. And yet I find myself thinking 2 months is a long time.
It's a long time, and we don't know yet who will be running Facebook in his absence. There's a lot of speculation this morning that it'll be Sheryl Sandberg, but we're not really sure who that is. Facebook stock is a bit down in response to that, I think because there's so much mystery over, well, who's going to be running the ship in your absence. So it'll be really interesting to see, but I think the biggest thing will be to watch what happens in the next year or two with employees taking advantage of parental leave, if they're going to mimic that, or if they're still going to be kind of a sense of this very cutthroat mentality right now in Silicon Valley where people feel like they can't take any time off for anything.
Hey, honey, I need a break. Let's have a baby. That's Amy Guth, the host of the Business Lunch on Saturdays. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.